welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 372. My name is Camden Busey, and I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois, way up in the northeast corner of the state. And it's a nice day today, but it's going to be even nicer because I have with me Jim Cassidy, who's a church planter and soon to be installed pastor of South Austin OPC, looking to particularize soon. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to have you with us, and good news on the church plant.
Yeah, I don't know. First of all, I don't know if I could really do much to improve your day up there all the way in Illinois, but I am having a good day myself down here in Austin, Texas. And yeah, we're thankful. The Lord's been gracious to us. We are in the process of particularization, and hopefully, Lord willing, by the end of February 27th, in fact, we hope to have our particularization service where the Presbytery of the Southwest will officially recognize us as a new and separate congregation of the OPC. So praise God.
Praise the Lord. Yeah. We also have with us from Texas, Pflugerville, Texas, that is, Glenn Clary, who is the pastor of Providence OPC. Welcome back, Glenn. It's so great to have you again.
Thank you very much, Camden. It's good to be here again. And we are very excited about the particularization of the South Austin Church, too, and are looking forward to being involved in that service.
Yeah. Yet another congregation in Texas, and a lot of things going on there, a lot of good news. I hope we can plant some more churches here in the Midwest, I believe. I don't know if we're the largest presbytery. I think we might be. But it sounds like you might catch us if you keep going at this rate.
Yeah, well, you guys are quite large. I don't know if we could ever. You guys are a bit bloated up there. You need to do something about that.
Hey. We run lean. We might be big. We're like Brahma Bull, though. Not a lot of fat on us, I guess.
That's right.
I'm going to stick up for the PMW here. Yeah, a lot of good things going on.
Represent.
Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord for his church, and especially that his Reformed church is continuing to grow. We thank him for all the work that he's done and the ways he's blessed the OPC. And a lot of good news in a lot of Reformed denominations, URCNA, RPCNA, hearing a lot of good things going on in quarters of the PCA. So we're very thankful, and we want to have a wonderful episode today talking about Presbyterianism in general, but more specifically speaking about the Confessional Presbyterian Journal. We have the 10th issue. They come out annually. Another beautiful volume here in front of us. We're going to speak about this issue today in its entirety. I'm going to at least give you an idea of what's in it and try to encourage you and persuade you to pick up a copy if you don't have one already. But before we do that, we want to mention that Christ the Center is listener supported. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners, our viewers, our readers to help us produce and distribute tons and tons of Reformed resources, which are all distributed and accessible free of charge. You can visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate. If you go there, you'll note that we have a new look to the website. I want to thank everybody for bearing with us. I put the new design up and was working on it intermittently. I've been trying to do this for over a year, but being busy as a pastor and other things, it's been tough to get the motivation to do it, and it's been in the back of my mind. So one day I just said, you know what, I'm just going to put it out as is. I know it'll be painful for a few days, but I've been working on it, tweaking a few things, getting it back running. So we got a few complaints, but hopefully I've been able to address most of those, and everything should be there. Site to me is working, and there's still several things on my list that I want to fix. But one thing you'll note is I believe it's more readable, easier to find things. It's a simpler, but we're going to try to make it even better for you to find resources. And of course, you can easily at the top of the new page, click on the donate button. That'll take you right to the donate page, and you can sign up and donate either with a one-time gift or a recurring gift of any frequency, up to you, and any amount with our new donation system. A lot of good things going on in the back end at Reformed Forum, but we need your help to be able to do even more. So we encourage you to visit us online today. We would thank you so much for your support of everything we do at Reformed Forum and of this particular program, Christ the Center. All right, guys. Well, this new issue here in front of us has a cover of a very important figure, a guy that looks at me every day. I've got a portrait of J. Gresham Machen over my head here in my study, and he just stares at me all day. And if I try to turn away from his inquisitive stare, then I have Van Til on my backside. I can't go anywhere but see these giants in our Reformed tradition, and there's a good reason that Machen's on the cover here. What is the journal celebrating, Jim, and why feature Machen at this point in time?
Yeah, this is the 10th anniversary or 10th issue of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal. The first issue came out in 2005. You may be interested to know, however, that the inaugural issue of 2005 is no longer in print. It's no longer available. So if you are one of those, if you have one of those original 2005s, put it away and save it because it's a collector's item. Nobody else can buy anymore, and it'll be worth millions of dollars someday. I doubt it. But but it's pretty cool that that if you do have one,
I
of
do
those,
have one.
Yeah,
I have them all.
That's right. You're actually in a very unique category and club.
So, keep your eyes on eBay to see if there's any million-dollar copies, but I'm holding on to mine.
Hold on to it and continue to enjoy it. Obviously, these issues are just beautifully done. So, back around when I was in Johnstown, I was pastoring, and the first issue, came to me, and I went ahead and contacted the chief editor, who is Chris Caldwell. He is the founder of the journal. He has a very unique gift for doing publishing in a way that is high quality publishing, and you could tell by the journal that not only is the content solidly, unequivocally confessional and Presbyterian in its orientation, but the publication is actually of great quality as well. He has worked very hard in terms of typesetting, being able to put together an issue that is not only theologically delicious, as it were, but it's also quite a feast to the eyes as well. So he's wanting to bring those two things together and does it extremely well.
Should say the picture on the front, once again, is done by Mike Mahan, who is a noted artist. We've had him on the program before. Many years ago, he did a Reformed Media Review. Mike does some wonderful portraits, and on the back of the journal edition, you'll see the previous 9 covers, which all have portraits by Mike Mahan. One's by Calvin, Warfield, there's Knox. I mean, just some big figures in Presbyterianism, and it's nice to see kind of a threefold portrait of Machen here, some classic posings that we've seen of Machen in the past, but with Mike's characteristic brushstroke and his colors here gracing the cover of issue number 10.
Yeah, pretty cool. Mike is actually a member of our presbytery, and yeah. I didn't know that until the September presbytery meeting when I ran into him. I actually had lunch with him, didn't even know who he was sitting at the table until we got talking, and finally heard someone refer to him by his last name, and I said, wait, are you the guy who does the artwork for the Confessional Presbyterian Journal? And he said, yeah. And so we had a chance to talk, and really, really great guy, ruling elder at one of our New Mexico churches. Yeah. And anyway, just he does great work for us. And this cover, I think, is this one takes the cake. This is this has got to be the best one that he has done, I think, to date, and it's just wonderfully attractive. And anyway, it adorns the cover, and so much of the opening material of this issue has to do with Machen. And one of the things that we wanted to, one of the reasons why we brought Machen into this was because we wanted to highlight some controversial issues within Presbyterianism in this issue, and who better to adorn the cover of the journal when we're focusing on controversy than the head warrior himself, Machen. So we're very happy to be able to have him on the cover of this issue.
And before we get into the contents of this particular issue, why don't you explain your involvement with the journal and your history with it, Jim?
Yeah, so as I was saying before, I reached out to Chris when the first issue came out and told him just how much I really, really appreciated the journal. And I went ahead and submitted an article to him the following year, and it was an article on N.T. Wright and his critical realistic hermeneutics. And Chris graciously received that and published it in that issue of the journal, And then after that, he came to me and invited me on board to help with the editing work, and probably just because I expressed so much appreciation for the journal, and nobody else apparently wanted the job, and so I went ahead and took on that job, and I've been working with him ever since, and it's just been a great joy. We've also expanded our editorial board to include Jeff Waddington, of course, who's a contributor here at Crisis Center, and also Nick Wilburn, who is a pastor, PCA pastor, and an associate professor at Greenville Seminary. So we really have a wonderful group of guys who work really hard at making sure that this journal produces good quality material. And whether or not we succeeded in that, we'll leave in the hands of our readers.
Mm. Now, Glenn, now you have an article in here. I think we can get started there. Of course, there are some articles on Machen here. Barry Waugh has written, but since we have Glenn with us today, why don't we start with that? Page 100, we have this great article. I just read it last night, The Liturgical Nature of Ecclesial Ministry. Glenn, when did you write this, and what were your thoughts as you put this piece together?
I wrote it just last year, 2014, and I was aiming to develop a theology of ministry that was liturgically oriented. And my particular area of expertise is in the study of Christian worship, not in ecclesiology. But I wanted to blend those two disciplines somewhat in this article and try to develop a liturgically oriented theology of ministry that is in keeping with our covenantal and eschatological understanding of ecclesiology. So this is the first article I've contributed to the Confessional Presbyterian Journal that is purely of a theological or biblical theological nature. The previous two articles I submitted were of a historical theological nature, but this one focuses on biblical theology and practical ministry.
You know, and I noted that all your articles have been insightful and interesting, but this particular one, it broke things down in a very helpful way. Just to begin, some people who might be new to the field might wonder exactly what the scope of liturgical is, and you spend a bit of time speaking about some of the Greek words behind that. Could you define some terms for us and let us know the scope of your article and what you're attempting to address?
Sure. The word liturgical is derived, liturgy is derived from the Greek word liturgia, and I simply use that as a synonym for worship, and I'm only doing that because it's easier to do that, I think, to use the word liturgical or liturgia than it is to write worship or theology of worship or practice of worship, etc. So I'm arguing in the article that worship is a constitutive element of every form of ecclesial ministry, or to say it another way, that ecclesial ministry is inherently and pervasively liturgia, the worship of God. So it is a liturgically oriented theology of ministry that I am trying to develop, or to develop the idea that Christian ministry is liturgia. It is inherently liturgia and pervasively liturgia. And I'm aiming in the article to recover a theology of ministry, a theology of ecclesial ministry that is in accordance with our Reformed doctrine of the church, which emphasizes the covenantal dimension of the church as well as the eschatological dimension of the church. So I was trying to blend all of these ideas together to develop a theology of ministry that encompasses all of these strands within Reformed ecclesiology.
Very interesting material here, the liturgical nature of ecclesial ministry. We hope to get into this a little bit further and discuss it in detail, but just for the sake of overall review, Jim, why don't you tell us some of the other features of this particular issue?
Okay, great. We could go systematically through at the beginning and then go through the end of the issue. I almost never read a journal that way. It's It's kind of boring. So why don't we I want to direct our listeners to the Sick at Non piece that's in there. There is a give and take, a back and forth between Mark Garcia and Michael Horton on the question of the relationship between law and gospel.
And this has been going on for a couple issues, right? Is this the third issue?
I think, the third issue that this Sick at Non has been going on concerning Westminster Seminary, Westminster West's distinctives, their particular aspects that are distinctive to their understanding of doctrine and et cetera. And so this has been going on back and forth for quite some time. This is going to be – this is the last of the exchanges that we'll see here. And then the second of the Sick at Nons that are in there is the one with Jeff Waddington and David Van Drunen with regard to the Two Kingdoms doctrine. So once again, I found these pieces to be very helpful. If any of our listeners are kind of scratching their heads and saying, you know, I don't really understand what's going on, you know, the debates, what the issues are surrounding Westminster, California's distinctive theology, you pick up this issue and then the last two issues, and what you'll find is you'll be very quickly oriented to what the central core elements and elements are of debate. So that's a very helpful section that we have in here. I kind of, when I first opened the article, the journal, I went right to that section. I would have gone to Glenn's article first, but I had already read it during editing. So I was able to skip over that.
Yeah, right.
I was able to skip over that and get right to the Sick at Nons. Also, the book reviews and responses are very, very helpful as well. There are a couple of back and forth exchanges that are there that I found to be very helpful. You know, highlighting current trends and issues. Chris Caldwell has a piece in here that's entitled "The Anti-Sabbatarian Scold: Thomas Rogers' Letter to Nicholas Abound," and Chris has a way of being able to dig up and find these old documents that are either no longer available or are rare in their availability, and take them and be able to bring them, to audiences today, in bringing these issues up light and bringing new light upon them and bringing them to us afresh again. So very, very helpful piece that I really enjoyed. You had mentioned the pieces by Barry Waugh. There's the very fascinating article that he has on Machen and his cousin, and what you'll find in that article, if you look in there and read through it, are a number of pictures that have been dug up from archives somewhere. That are not readily available. They're not very popular pictures of Machen that you find all over the web or whatever that many people have seen hanging up at Westminster Seminary. These are pretty rare photos. And the best one is at the end of that article, where there's a picture of the Benham Club, where the students are gathered together. And there's a picture of Machen in the back left corner, and he has his hair parted down the middle, and he's wearing a mustache on. And anyone who has seen enough pictures of Machen, I dare you to find a picture of Machen with a mustache. I mean, you just don't see him with facial hair generally. Here he's got a mustache on, and we had a discussion among the editors as to whether or not this was just a rare instance where he grew some facial hair, or if he was perhaps doing this knowing Machen's kind of cheeky personality. If he was doing this as kind of a spoof, and we concluded that because there's some evidence to show that a very popular in the club was this idea known as stunting, which was, spoofing. It was being goofy or doing something funny. And it's speculated here that Machen was coming out of his normal character, parting his hair down the middle, getting this kind of big mustache on his face, and in fact that he is stunting here in this club photo. So really fun piece. These photos are just worth the price of the issue alone. So really, really good stuff. If you want to get to know Machen a little bit better, this particular piece is really, really helpful. So,
and I like the dog in that picture too.
Yeah, it's pretty clever, isn't it? You know, you got this. Firehouses are known for having their mascot dog. Well, the club also apparently had a mascot too.
Got to have a mascot.
Yeah, so Machen was providing comic relief, I guess, in the picture.
That's exactly right. That's what's speculated. That's right. Uh-huh. Yep. So a couple of these other articles in here, you know, again, just some really good ones. There's one, there's a sermon here on Genesis chapter 9 by Joseph Rollison. It's quite good, actually. I've read through that, really good. But I want to highlight, if I could, Nick Wilborn's article on the diaconate. This is his third article that he has written on the diaconate. There's the one previous to this one is also published in the Confessional Journal, and then there's another one in a book. It's an essay in a book, I think, called "Confessing Our Hope." I think it was a Festschrift for Morton Smith, if I'm correct, if my memory serves me. Anyway, Nick has written a tremendous piece here for us. It's kind of, you know, I'm training two deacons now in our church, and I've kind of searched high and far and low looking for good theologically informed and reformed rich material on the diaconate. And I just haven't been able to find a whole lot that's out there. Nick Wilborn's piece here has kind of filled that niche. So I would encourage those who are looking for a very thoughtful Presbyterian and Reformed approach to the diaconate to go ahead and pick up this article, check it out, and share it with your deacons. If you're training deacons, make sure that they get a chance to read it as well. It's just a very helpful, useful piece. Also, Andy Perry, I had a chance to edit this article. I had a privilege of editing this article, but, you know, if you find any mistakes in there.
Well, I think I can print this and hand it out to all of the people in the service on Sunday.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is a very useful piece for pastors.
I'm just kidding.
It's good. This is a type of article that's really good to get in the hands of the laity, because you know, he talks about the idea of profitable hearing of sermons. So, you know, we see a lot of literature being written out there about the importance, the centrality of preaching sermons, stuff for ministers, but there's not a whole lot that's out there that instructs the congregation on how to listen to sermons, how to hear sermons. And this is all the more timely because of living in a kind of a advanced technological age where we're kind of entertainment saturated. And to be able to retain people's attention with words as opposed to images is not a very easy thing to do. And so we need to train our people to listen to sermons and how to listen to them. It's a very practical piece that I found to be tremendously useful.
Yeah, I think if I can chime in here, I think that's a very important part of pastoral ministry, is not only for the pastor himself to have a biblical and reformed theology of preaching, but to teach that same theology of preaching to the congregation. And that, I think, will develop their understanding of what the purpose of the sermon is, the aim of the sermon, what to expect from the sermon, and help to train them on how to listen to a sermon. And and whether we as pastors recognize it or not, our people have a theology of preaching. They come to the service with a theology of preaching, and they come to the service with an idea of what the preacher is trying to accomplish and what they expect to get out of the sermon. And so that's why after every service, you pretty much have an evaluation given to you, a sermon evaluation given to you as a pastor for members in the church. And so even when people come up and say good sermon, I've often wondered, well, why did you think it was a good sermon? Did it do what you were expecting it to do? You know, did it have something in it that you were looking for? So what's your criteria for evaluation? And so I think this is very important, training people, you know, what preaching is and developing in them a theology of preaching so that they would know how to listen to a sermon. I think it's an essential part of pastoral ministry.
Yeah, amen. I'd like to echo those comments as well. I've often wondered, I think all pastors kind of had this experience where you get up there and you feel like that you just preached a bomb, you know, just a terrible sermon. Somebody comes up afterwards and they say, that was a great sermon.
Well, I've never had that experience.
Yeah, and then when you think you preached a zinger or an amazing sermon, and then nobody says anything.
Yeah, and it's nothing but complaints, actually.
Complaints. You know,
if nobody said anything, I'd be happy, but, you know, it's nothing but complaints.
Those are helpful reminders that
exactly.
The power is not in the preacher or in the
right.
delivery.
But then it is indicative of what people are looking for in sermons. I had a lady in a previous congregation come up to me after. She goes, wow, that sermon was spot on. And she proceeded to tell me why she thought it was spot on. And what she thought was so great about the sermon wasn't the point that I was trying to make at all. It was actually a very different point than the point I was trying to hit home. She had somewhere along the line misunderstood what I was trying to say. And that may have been my fault, but, you know, the point is people are listening in a way that's very different than the way in which you are listening as a preacher. And so we need to be able to train people what to look for, you know, what makes a good sermon, what you know, how to listen, how to listen consciously. And all of that is just very, very helpful things to be thinking about.
Yeah.
So anyway, moving on, a couple of other articles we've got. We got McLeod Campbell, Edwards and the Atonement by Jeff Stuyvesant.
Jeff Stuyvesant we've had on the program before to speak about his dissertation on Warfield.
Yep.
A very interesting piece, and I'd encourage people to listen to that episode. He also came, I don't know if you remember, Jim, but he came to the Reform Forum Theology Conference back in October and had a good time speaking with him.
The first time I think I met Jeff was at the conference.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, myself and Jeff Waddington and Jeff Stuyvesant were sitting in the lobby of the hotel one night just chatting, talking. He's a RPCNA minister serving in the Pittsburgh area and doing some really, really good work. And he did his PhD at Westminster, I believe, if I'm not mistaken about that.
Yes, you did.
Really, really good, worth reading all the time, really, our brother Jeff. Barry Waugh has another article in here, an extraordinary case of the use of the extraordinary clause, which is kind of interesting. I haven't read through the whole article, so I don't know the full details of the line of argumentation he makes, other than to say that he's dealing with the issue of credentialing, I believe. What is an exception when it comes to fulfilling ordination standards? In other words, we have certain, let's say, educational standards. You know, somebody in order to be licensed has to have fulfilled so much academic training. In order to be ordained, he has to have had filled so much academic training. But both the PCA and the OPC have exception clauses in there. What do you do in the case of a guy who doesn't have that education? and is being called to a church in your presbytery, what does it mean that there's an extraordinary situation or an extraordinary situation where the man may have his education requirements waived or something to that effect? So he goes through and highlights some cases that have taken place in the past in church history, et cetera. And Barry is, of course, a historian. He's published a number of stuff here on Reform Forum on figures, I guess, profiles, right?
Yeah, he has a whole series, Presbyterians of the Past. We're featuring that right now on the homepage slider image. For the moment, it's the first thing that pops up on the website, and you can go back into the archives and read a bunch of those. He writes them regularly, and they're insightful, kind of vignettes into some forgotten stories and forgotten figures of the Presbyterian past.
Yeah, and he's also written for Westminster Seminary, a history of the seminary as well.
He sure has.
That's very nicely done. I don't know if it's still available, Camden. Do you know if
that? Oh, I'm sure they have copies. If you call either the communications or admissions department, they probably have several they can get into your hands.
Yeah. Okay,
and he edited the volume on Machen's letters from the front at World War I.
Yeah,
so Barry has done quite a bit of work in Presbyterian history and with Machen as well.
If I could also highlight one other article that Barry, not to make this the Barry show, but Barry wrote an article in the Westminster Journal not long ago. Let me see if I could gather the details. It was about a relationship, a friendship that Machen had struck up
With a drunk, kind of a homeless man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, down in Vineland, New Jersey. And he used to and he ministered to this guy for a number of— it's a fascinating story, and Barry tells it very well. So if you are a subscriber to the Journal and skipped over that article when you got the Journal, and I'm sorry, I'm the exact volume number is eluding me right now, but go ahead and pick up that article and read it. It's just it's a relaxing, fun read. It's told because Barry makes reading his history telling so easy. He's such a good writer. So go ahead and pick that up. It's a fascinating story. Okay, so moving on, we have also, I'm going to try to pronounce this brother's name correctly, but Jay Un Park wrote an article on Stephen Karnak's Christological Knowledge of God, and I believe that Jay Un is a student of Muller's at Calvin Seminary, if I'm recalling correctly. Mm-hmm. And it's typical, and by that, by saying typical, I mean in a good sense. It's typical. It's vintage. It's the type of stuff you would expect from a Muller student. Very, very close, careful, rich analysis of Reformed scholasticism. So very, very well done. And then there's Dr. Ben Shaw's work on De Jure Divino Presbyterianism and Divine Right Presbyterianism. And again, that piece was very practical, helpful for understanding Presbyterianism. And I love this one, Roland Barnes' article.
I want Glenn to talk about this one.
I'm going to set Glenn up for this one. Yeah, I don't know if Glenn has had a chance to look at it yet or not, but there's this piece on the practice of Lent in the Reformed tradition, and the Reformed tradition. This is a timely piece because of kind of this what seems to be a resurgence in Reformed circles of for reasons I can't seem to fathom, a resurgence in the practice of Lent. I don't know if Glenn has some thoughts in that regard.
You ever thought about that, Glenn?
No, I don't have any thoughts on that.
You have no
at
opinions
all
on that, do you?
Right, right.
No opinions, yeah. I'm very eager to read this article and unfortunately have not had a chance to do so yet. So if you can kind of summarize what his position is on it, that may be helpful for discussion.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically he goes through and he explains why the Reformed tradition rejected Lent as a practice. That's the overview without getting into the details. But we don't have to get into the details in order to kind
of whet the appetite of the reader.
Get your thoughts of what. Yeah, I mean, because we've kind of done a show on this.
A few weeks ago, Glenn talked about this issue. It's toward the end of the episode, but we had a good, healthy chunk in which Glenn explained Reformed practice of worship and how Lent and its history and its essence really is opposed to that subject. But another article here by Roland Barnes, it should be an interesting and important read on the subject.
Yeah, it looks like he sketches the history of the development of Lent and how much the history of Lent leans on the work of Dionysius the Areopagite, which is really best called the Dionysius the pseudo Areopagite or pseudo Dionysius. It was the Christian humanist prior to the Reformation who exposed that the works of Dionysius the Areopagite, which of course was supposed to be the convert of the Apostle Paul in Acts chapter 17, who was, you know, Dionysius was a member of the Areopagus. It was exposed by, I think it was Lorenzo Valla, a Christian humanist, prior to the Reformation, that this was a fraud, a fraudulent work. It was not, second century, an early second century or first century piece, but it was much later than that. In the history of the church, but so much of the asceticism and the Neoplatonism that was dominant in Roman Catholic theology during the time of the Reformation was derived from the works of Pseudo Dionysius.
And
that, of course, is the heart of Lent. You know, Lent is asceticism. You know, the practice of Lent is going through ascetic practices to make a person prepare a person for communion on Easter Sunday.
So it's in its essence kind of semi-Pelagian.
Yes, very semi-Pelagian.
And what was the Reformed tradition, why did they reject the practice of Lent?
Well, several reasons. One, as we covered, you know, a few weeks ago when we were talking about Zwingli and the Reformation in Zurich, Zwingli objected to the imposition of the ascetic rites during the Lenten season because there was no biblical warrant for it, and that the church had no right to impose a fast of any kind because Scripture doesn't do so. You know. And so one of the arguments was an argument based on sola scriptura and the limit of church authority, limits of church authority. Another one of the arguments would be just a rejection in general of asceticism. And also another one of the arguments would be the theological, soteriological implications of the practice of Lent as well, that through these ascetic practices one earns righteousness, so works righteousness. So there's basically three arguments: the argument against asceticism, the argument against works righteousness, and the argument against the imposition of man-made traditions.
When you understand all that, it really makes you ask the question: why the reinstitution of Lent, revitalizing the Lenten practices within the Reformed context. I don't know if you have any guesses as to why this is becoming a trendy thing again.
I have some guesses. I mean, it is a trendy thing. I think that's something that needs to be recognized. This is just another one of those liturgical trends: the recovery of the church calendar, the emphasis on liturgical ceremony and gesture and so on, that has somehow caught on within some Reformed circles. And I think it's really the fruit of the liturgical renewal movement that began in Europe, in European churches, and made its way over to America in the mid-20th century and took off in the mainline churches. And has now and has been popularized in our country primarily by the University of Notre Dame. The liturgical scholars at Notre Dame have published many works on this, popularizing this in our own country. But then there are certain pockets within the Reformed Church that has been influenced by the liturgical renewal movement. I think you see it in the Federal Vision movement. You see it in many PCA churches that have adopted a high church liturgy of some sort, whether it be a Lutheran stripe, Anglican stripe, or whatever. But basically what has taken place already many decades ago in the mainline churches is now taking place in our own backyard, so to speak. And it's nothing. There's nothing new under the sun here. I mean, if you went back to the 19th century, you would see the same thing going on in the Oxford movement, which was, as Dr. Old put it, a dress rehearsal for the liturgical renewal movement. So it's just the fruit of the liturgical renewal movement coming into our own circles is what I think it is. It's a move away, I think, from, you know, Reformed theology and worship, and a move closer to Rome, a move back toward medieval worship even. And usually one of the main arguments for it is the Catholicity of the church. That's one of the arguments anyhow. I think it also is probably a reaction against a low view of the church, a low view of worship, a low view of the sacraments. And so, you know, the answer to a low view of sacramental theology is not the high church movement. It's classical Reformed. It's classical Reformed theology and sacramental theology, and classical Reformed worship. So I think it's, you know, the pendulum swing. You know, we go from a low view of the church and worship to, you know, high liturgy, and that's supposed to be the answer to it. I think the same thing was occurring in, to some extent in the 19th century with the Mercersburg movement and the Romanticism that kind of underlied the Mercersburg movement and Nevin and Schaff and so on.
That's a whole other episode in and of itself, isn't it? I mean, boy, we can just go unpack that. That whole trend, you know, take up a whole episode with it. It's,
I think that that type of material is what makes the Confessional Presbyterian so special. With Glenn's article, but also the one on Lent and Reformed practice, it is harder to find material like that at a scholarly level, collected in one place. You might find it here or there, but here you find material that is of concern to historically minded Reformed theologians who want to learn more about the practices of the past and why people did what they did. And it's no accident. And we don't have to reinvent the wheel or try to come up with all sorts of other new practices in the modern day. But it's helpful to realize the trajectory and the reasons why things have been played out in the past. It doesn't necessarily mean we have to agree. We should always be reformed according to Scripture. But a lot of those people, the Reformation, the Reformers, were pretty smart, and they were looking at the Scripture pretty well. And it seems like sometimes we end up in this pragmatic, weird haze in modern evangelicalism, and it's easy to get swept up in that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. It kind of an attempt to reinvent the wheel, which kind of betrays a certain, I don't know if ignorance is the word, or at least perhaps a neglect mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. tradition upon which we stand, and asking the question, okay, you know, why did the Reformers reject certain practices or certain doctrines? Did they have good reasons for it? And generally, if you're earnest enough to go look and find out, you'll find that that there were good reasons, you know, that it would give us caution in terms of moving forward with practices and doctrines that, you know, aren't helpful for the church.
Precisely, and we believe the church in general too. So the title of the journal is The Confessional Presbyterian, and that more or less is sort of its target market, but it should not be contained to those people only. I mean, this is a wonderful and helpful journal for Reformed people of all types, but even non or unreformed people, or people that are Reformed maybe in soteriology only, but would like to learn more about a critical and robust view of ecclesiology and things like that. This journal is an excellent collection, and year after year produces wonderful pieces that reorient us around the things that truly matter.
If I could just say one other thing that's really, really cool. I forgot to mention it earlier. We went many years without being indexed with ATLA, with the ATLA religion database, mm-hmm. Which you can find at most theological libraries to do research in. We are now indexed with them. So if you ever wanted to do research in the area of Reformed doctrine, or confessional Presbyterian Reformed doctrine, practice, life, whatever. A wonderful thing to do is if you have access to this database at our theological library, is use that. And if your library doesn't subscribe to and hold the Confessional Presbyterian Journal, make sure you tell them to get it and subscribe to it, so that they can have that at your fingertips when you go do your research, mm-hmm. And be able to pull it off the shelf and read some of these really, really very good articles.
Yeah. Do you have any understanding or any knowledge of if that's made a big difference in circulation or interest with the journal of these last few years being indexed?
I don't know the relationship between the increase in subscriptions and ATLA, but I do know that our subscription base has increased.
That's good.
It's grown over the years. We have had more and more libraries added to our subscriber list. And so it's gaining some momentum, but it's only 10 years in, which really in the world of academics is not very long.
No, it's not.
To establish a journal and such. But hopefully, Lord willing, God will give us energy enough to do so, enough energy to carry this on for years to come, and we can continue to keep producing this material for people to read and to enjoy and grow in.
Mm-hmm. I should say also that we have been privileged we have special discounts available to the journal now. So we're
yes.
very thankful to Chris Coldwell and the organization for sending over a special link that we're going to include in the episode description. Let me write this down, 5920. And so we have the volume 10, which is the latest issue, now on sale through the website for $20. So you can click mm-hmm. the link in the episode description, and you'll be able to see all these deals. There are also special offers on past issues. You can get volumes 4 and 7 together for $28. That's a big savings. You can also get volumes 2, 3, and 4 together for $38. So Chris has created a bunch of little packages here. And you can also get any single issue from volumes 2 through 9. Once again, volume 1 is gone. For $25. And I should mention, this isn't just some magazine. It is paperback. It's soft paper, but it's wonderfully done and wonderfully bound, and it's a large format. It's larger than a normal book. It's more like a textbook size. I don't have my ruler in front of me, but you're going to get almost 300 pages of a large format. And it's mostly typeset in 2 columns per page. It's very and highly readable, but it's a substantial piece, not just like you're getting a normal sized small little journal. It's a big piece with a lot of material in it. And so $20 for that is a good deal.
A steal. Yeah,
and you'll be able to get that online by clicking the special link we have included in the episode description. I want to thank Chris Caldwell for giving us that special link and putting these deals together for our listeners.
Yeah, please do support. I mean, if nothing else, if you appreciate what we do, please order just to support us, encourage us, let us know that you're behind our work, and it will continue to spur us on year after year. And we really, really do appreciate the support of those who read the journal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I echo that. And of course, Glenn, we're going to have to tap you to come back and we could talk in more detail about your article. I would like to get into it more. I should also mention that Glenn is teaching a course for the OPC's Ministerial Training Institute, and that's going to be ramping up soon, at least in terms of when this episode releases. I believe it may have already begun. But Glenn, could you give us maybe a preview about that course, and people can keep an eye out for it down the road?
Sure. The course starts in February. I think February the 2nd is when the course begins, and there are weekly assignments, reading assignments, and some written assignments that students will submit by email. And then at the end of the course in May, there is an intensive training seminar, which is going to be in Wheaton, Illinois. And I'm very excited about teaching this. This will be the first opportunity I have to teach for the Ministerial Training Institute of the OPC. And I got a good number of students in the class already, including one stellar student named Camden Busey. So
I'm getting my spit wads ready for class.
Well, I've taken a few of the MTI classes myself, and they're very helpful in orienting men toward a pastoral ministry. They're helpful for pastors and elders and other men who are interested in holding office in the church for various reasons. The course I'm teaching is on Reformed worship, but there are some other courses, of course, being taught this semester as well. One on ecclesiology, Dr. Craig Troxell will be teaching that. One on Presbyterian form of government, and Dr. Alan Strange will be teaching that. And then one on homiletics, taught by Reverend Bill Shishko. And so those are also running at the same time as well. And there's still time to sign up for those. If anyone out of the listeners out there is interested, there's certainly time to sign up.
It might be a little bit past the deadline by the date this recording's published, but we'll try to do what we can through other means, maybe Facebook and Twitter and whatnot, to let people know. But this is absolutely something people should look at. If you're in the OPC, it's a really great deal, especially if you are an ordained officer, whether a minister or an elder, and I believe deacons as well, that you can take this and they will reimburse you not only for the cost of the course, which is minimal, but also they will provide a special travel allowance, so you could even fly out and they'll cover a good chunk of that, provided that gets approved and that you do finish the course. But it's a wonderful deal. It's a great service that the denomination provides. And of course, it's not limited to OPC people, although some of the reimbursement, I believe, is. You can still take the course, and it's very affordable. So if there are other Reformed and Presbyterian people who would like to learn things like about apologetics or the doctrine of the church or Reformed worship and all of these other things that we're learning. Chad Van Dixhorn also teaches once in a while a course on the history of the Westminster Standards. So these are just stellar classes by experts. And you can check out more about that at opc.org. You do a search for MTI OPC on Google. I'm sure it'll come up. So I've been through a class, and as Glenn mentioned, I'm taking another. So I've been, very much appreciated the service of the denomination here. Yeah, so we'll have links to a lot of these things in the episode description, and be able to keep you updated about all the great things going on in the Reformed and Presbyterian world. Once again, you can find the Confessional Presbyterian there online at cpjournal.com, and you can find a special link to a discount on past issues as well as the current issue at our website, reformedforum.org. Click on this current episode and you'll find the link in the episode description. Online, you can find our new website as well as information about how to subscribe. You can download our feeds and subscribe to our feeds and get all of our episodes downloaded automatically to your computer. You can also stay updated with our blog posts and news. And we encourage you to get a hold of us. You can do so online through the comment field on our site. You can also send us an email at mail@reformedforum.org or tweet us at Reformed Forum. I want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.